From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The TV series Scrubs is a comedy about a hospital and the interns who work there. But one of the things its fans love is the humor about race and the expectations white and black people have of each other. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Angela Nissel about writing some of those scenes. She's a consulting producer on Scrubs and the author of a new comic memoir about being the daughter of an African-American mother and a white father. In a period where several new books by conservatives have made news for their criticisms of President Bush, a new book in praise of him has been published by conservative journalist Fred Barnes. We'll talk with Barnes about his new book, Rebel in Chief, and about Andrew Card's resignation as White House Chief of Staff. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you ask fans of the TV series Scrubs what they love about the show, you're likely to hear about how the show satirizes hospital life and the lives of young interns. But you're also likely to hear about how funny the show is on the subject of race and the expectations that white people, African Americans, and Latinos have of each other. My guest Angela Nissel has written for the show and is now a consulting producer. She comes at the subject of racial expectations with some personal expertise. Her mother is black, her father is white. Nissel was sent to inner city schools and largely white prep schools. She's written a new comic memoir called Mixed, My Life in Black and White. Here's a scene she wrote for Scrubs last year. J.D., a white doctor, is puzzling over the meaning of rap lyrics he just heard. He asks for some help from his best friend and fellow doctor, Turk, who's black. Then two white female doctors butt in. Here's J.D.
Half of what rappers say doesn't make any sense, like that Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre song. What does still hitting them corners and those ho-hos, girl, mean?
Many disadvantaged African Americans have limited nutritional choices. Therefore, they must subsist on ho-ho snack cakes. It's a black thing, bruh.
Actually, Turk, it's still hitting them corners in them Lolos, girl. It's Lolos, not ho-hos.
See, Turk, in the hood, a Lolo is a lowrider, or a car with an adjusted suspension that allows it to bounce up and down. And Dre and Snoop enjoy driving around together in their lowriders around the corners, or Lizzle Rizzles. I'm representing for them gangsters all across the world.
Still hitting them corners in them Lolos, girl.
Still taking my time to perfect the beat, and I still got love for the street.
Turk. You just got schooled on rap by the two whitest chicks in America.
None of you can prove it.
I got it on tape.
That's a scene from Scrubs. Angela Nissel, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us about writing that scene.
Oh, now, that scene was so hard because, first of all, you have to get permission to use lyrics from the rappers. So, and we tend to kind of do things a little late on Scrubs. We'll be filming on Monday, and we'll have the scenes ready on Sunday night. So I spent most of Monday morning calling around to a bunch of rappers trying to get permission to use their lyrics. And finally, when I found one that would let me use the lyrics, I had to go back and decode the lyrics, listen to them, and give them a meaning that they didn't have, what Turk could think they meant.
Like the ho-ho thing.
And also something that could be said on television. And then go back and have the two white girls explain it to Turk. But that scene was fun for me because it happens so much to me in my daily life. Being the only black writer on Scrubs, my first day, I remember a fellow writer came in and said, Angela, we're writing this scene with Turk. We need your help. How do black people say thank you? And I said, we usually just say thanks or thank you. And it's just amazing to me how many times I get asked, how do black people do this? Or funny.
Was there a black writer on Scrubs before you joined?
No, I walked into an all-white writing staff, and I come to find out that's how most comedy staffs are in Hollywood, at least on the major three networks.
Do you ever disagree with white writers on the show about what will be offensive to African Americans and where the line is between, you know, funny and bad taste?
Oh, yes. There are times that I have gone into my room, my office, and have cried because trying to get writers, the majority of whom are rich white males, to think outside of their usual frame of reference is a hard thing. And when there's a whole room laughing at something, it's hard to be the one person who breaks through the laughter and says, you know, guys, some people might actually not find that funny. Even just certain things like our character Turk dancing a lot. You don't want to have Turk be the step and fetch it character. There's a line between funny and offensive. And to be the one that brings down the party in the room by saying, maybe we shouldn't dress JD up as Turk one more time. Or maybe Turk plays basketball a little too much. He's a surgeon. You always come off as the party pooper. But I know from my friends and their feedback on the show, certain things do bother them. So I really try to take that into consideration because this reaches so many people. And I remember growing up as a child and being embarrassed when certain scenes came on TV.
Now you've said that the kind of humor that you write for Scrubs, you feel you couldn't write on a show that was predominantly African American.
It's I'm lucky it's Scrubs because the show is based on the idea of the showrunner, and our creator, Bill Lawrence, is very open to new ideas. And a lot of African-American shows that I watch now fall into a lot of the same stereotypes, and most Black people I know don't really watch them. The jokes will be about the same subject matter, like hair or dancing, or you can't dance, you're not really Black type things. And I said, God, what happened to the days of the Cosby Show and Different World and Rock? Some of the shows I used to watch that brought up real issues, but also had comedy. And I feel like I'm free to kind of push the envelope a little bit. Luckily, because of we have a lot of freedom at Scrubs, which we're lucky. We don't have a lot of executives coming by and checking our scripts and saying, you can't do this, you can't do that. And we have a showrunner who will take chances and do things that I'll say, trust me on this one. Trust me. Black people will get it. Like, for instance, we were doing a show where JD has a Black girlfriend. And he said, what are some stereotypes about white people? We were just talking, just shooting the breeze, which is how most show ideas come up. And I said, well, there's a thing among Black people where we always think that white people smell like wet dog. And the room was just stunned. They said, no way. Are you serious? And so I had to call three Black people on speakerphone to prove to them. I said, called my best friend. Hey, what do Black people say white people smell like? Wet dog. You know, and so, until they would believe me. And they said, that is amazing. We have to put that on the air. And I think that's the only show where I could get away with making a wet dog joke.
So how did you use it?
JD's girlfriend, if I'm remembering correctly, made a comment about people smelling like wet dog, JD smelling like wet dog, and it just blew JD away. It just was like, wet dog? He'd never heard that. And JD said something about being a slave in front of his Black girlfriend, and he was like, oh my God, you just mentioned slavery in front of your Black girlfriend. You know, say something else, cover. And so it's the thoughts that really go through people's heads when they're talking to each other, or the real way that people talk. And I also think it's funny because a lot of Black people after that episode were like, you gave away our secret. I was like, I didn't know wet dog was a secret. You know, it's, but then I also found out certain things. They're like, that white guys who have dated Black girls have always wanted to ask Black women, but never got around to doing. And I just think that type of comedy is great. All those things that we keep inside because we're afraid of offending people. I love that stuff.
What are the things they want to ask that they don't ask?
Why? Number one question, which I love. Why does my Black girlfriend not like me to touch her hair? And why does she refuse to get on water rides? I'm like, because it takes a long time to get those Black hairdos. If you don't see your girlfriend all day Saturday, she's not cheating on you. She is in the hair salon. And water ruins it. As a child, I had to learn to swim with my head above water. And two, I know a lot of my Black girlfriends have weaves in their hair, which a lot of white girls are getting now, where the hair is either glued or braided to your scalp. Your guy can't run his fingers through your hair if there's glue holding it in. So you just kind of, you know, massage my shoulders, baby. Just do the shoulders, you know. So it's but I found it just so fascinating that white guys were with someone but never had the courage to say, why don't you ever want to go swimming with me? Or why can't I run my fingers through your hair? And I said, wow, you know, you're in love with someone, but you're still not comfortable because of the race issue to ask them something.
So do you think that you and the white writers on Scrubs are comfortable talking to each other about racial issues?
The writers and I are very comfortable talking to each other. There is that line, and I've crossed it and they've crossed it, where it gets very personal. And there are topics like religion and race that are very close to people's hearts, and they believe very strongly in certain things. There have been arguments. There have been screaming matches, people driving off, threatening to quit, you know? But I think from all of that comes the humor. Now, I think because most of us have worked together for at least 4 years, we're extremely comfortable, and we know the lines where to go and not to go with each other. There's one Republican in our room, and we refer to ourselves as the two minorities because we're always getting picked on, him for the Republican jokes and me for the Black jokes. So we kind of team up, and sometimes he takes the Black jokes on and I take the Republican jokes. So,
do you think writing for Scrubs, in which race isn't often, is a frequent theme, and being the only African-American writer in a writing staff that's predominantly white. Do you think that's the way, changed the way you talk about race outside of Scrubs?
Yes, but it's not, I wouldn't say that it's changed it for the better. I get so comfortable talking about race at Scrubs that I forget that everyone doesn't talk about it like that. So sometimes I'm trying to think of a specific comment, but I just know that I am now comfortable at laughing at any type of joke. Whereas before, if someone told a Jewish joke or if someone told a gay joke, I was like, am I allowed to laugh? Now I'm like the laughing the loudest in the room. And sometimes I'll see people look at me like, how dare you laugh? That's our joke. And I'm like, you know, but it has made me more comfortable talking about race. Also knowing how to talk about race, that people always take it a little bit easier when you add some sugar to it, as my mom would say. You know, start off with a joke if you have a question.
Well, you know, you put your finger on something I wanted to ask you about. Often in humor, it's assumed that if you're Jewish, you could tell a Jewish joke. If you're African-American, you could tell a black joke. But if you're Jewish, you shouldn't tell a black joke. And if you're black, you shouldn't tell a Jewish joke. So now on your staff, you know, you and the white writers, you're telling jokes for characters who are black and white. So do you have that sense of ownership that only, like, you know, the black writer can tell the black jokes, only the white writers can tell the white jokes?
No, not at all, because if they relied on me for all of the black jokes, the show would not have as many. It's mostly comes out of the questions and the questions that they ask about black people. For instance, one of our writers said, Angela, I was watching this documentary and Harry Belafonte went to a prison and this guy had never met an inmate. He gave him one of those cool handshakes and the guy automatically knew what to do. He knew how to follow the handshake. How do they do it? And I said, I don't know. I really didn't know. So we called my brother in Philadelphia on speakerphone and my brother said, well, you just kind of, it's like ballroom dancing. You kind of, one person takes the lead and you follow. And the guy said, well, what happens if you mess up the shake? He says, that's when you draw the guy in for the one arm hug. Like, you see that? And I was fascinated. I said, I always see like the rappers and the basketball players giving each other that one arm, like manly hug. And I said, wow, so that's when they mess up the handshake or when they just both want to get the handshake over with. And so now we're using that in Scrubs. We've put it on the list of funny things to do when JD constantly gets the handshake wrong and is always pulling people in for these one-arm hugs. So it's like most of the stuff just comes out of talking.
Is there a character on the show who you particularly relate to or who particularly reflects you?
I think it would have to be Elliot. And at first I thought I would relate to Carla a bit more because she's a bit more mature, but it's definitely Elliot. Because Elliot's this neurotic woman who was unsure of herself and tended to put her foot in her mouth a lot, didn't know when to shut up, and that was me, totally, but is slowly learning that she's capable, even if she keeps the idea that she's not capable stuck in the back of her mind. And I totally relate to her. I relate to some of the situations she's in, being in an environment that's mostly male, too, because me in the writer's room, when she, on one episode, she asked the guys, she said, you actually rate the women of this hospital in terms of appearance? And they said, yes, we do, number 12 or something like that. She was like, yes, top 20. You know, and I'm like, oh, that's totally me. I'd be appalled to know that they were rating me. But if I made it in the top 20, I'd secretly be so happy. I love writing for Elliot.
But no, so you're writing for Elliot. She's white. And also, mm-hmm. she'd be like the Republican?
Yes.
So she's not, in some ways, she's really not like you.
But it's, I find, and this is due to my background, a lot of the things that you go through in life, I feel like this is such like a Oprah moment, but a lot of the things that you go through in life that you're like, why am I going through this? They really do have a purpose later on. And being the outsider in the room, if Elliot is the Republican on the show, she's the outsider. And being the woman among the main characters, the only woman doctor, she's the outsider. And I think that people who have ever had the experience of being outside, which most of us have, can relate to characters like that. And that's why I like writing for her, because her perspective is a little different from JD's and Turk's. They're best friends. Despite their color, they see things, a lot of things, in the same way, where she'll see them in a totally different way, and she can add a fresh angle to things.
My guest is Angela Nissel. She writes for the NBC TV series Scrubs and has a new memoir about being biracial called Mixed. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Angela Nissel, and she's a consulting producer for Scrubs. She's been writing for the show for, what, about 4 years?
Yes.
And she has a new memoir, which is called Mixed, My Life in Black and White. And Angela, your new memoir is about being biracial. Your mother's African-American. Your father is white. How did they meet? And I should preface this by saying your mother, when she met your father, was a Black Panther. So
yes,
yeah. So how did they meet and start dating?
Now, what's interesting is that my mother and father both have very different versions of their first meeting. My mother's side is that she thought my father was half Black, which I find a little curious because my father has straight red hair and green eyes, and he's very pale with freckles. So I said, okay, but his mother remarried a Black man. So he was living in the hood with a white mother and a Black stepfather. So my mom says, I thought the stepfather was his real father. So that's the reason I started dating him. Only about after we had started going out for about a couple weeks and we were dancing once, I said, hey, are you all white? And he said, yeah. And she said, I was shocked, but I was already in love with him. And my father says, your mother knew I was white. You know, he said, I used to come over her house and play chess with your aunt. You know, she totally knew I was white. But they met because my father was the only white guy in the Black neighborhood. And it's funny because he doesn't find anything odd about that. But I remember growing up, all of his friends being Black and having names like Leroy and Hassan. I said, my father has no Brians or Gregs coming over the house. So just that he happened to live in the same neighborhood she lived in.
Did your mother's friends think that it took away from her movement credentials to be with a white man?
You know, we've never really talked about that. I know that she said that Black men, when they would see her on the street and with her afro and with her Power to the People jacket, walking with my father, they would say, oh, you know, you're not really down for the struggle. You're with this white guy. And she also talks about how the white nurses, my mother's a nurse, that she went to school with knew her during her militant days. So when she gave birth to me in the hospital, I was extremely light and I had strawberry blonde hair when I came out. And my mother's like, that's my baby. And there was a huge ruckus about who's going to give the white baby to the Black Panther. You know, like, we're not handing this baby over to her. So she had to bring my father in and say, no, really, that's my baby. I'm married to him. And she just said, everyone was like, what happened to her?
When you're biracial, your race is in a way different than either of your parents. So you're experiencing something racially in America that your parents haven't experienced firsthand. So did that kind of separate you in any way from each of your parents? Make you feel different from them?
Definitely. I don't know if my mother and father had a talk when I was born, but I know that my mother handled all of my race questions. And when I was very young, and before she split up with my dad, I was about 8 when they broke up, she would just say, you're Black and you're white and you're beautiful. I always say that she sounded like she was the public relations manager for mixed children. But I always wondered when I was young, why am I not Black and white, like a zebra or something, you know? And people would constantly tease me for being Black and white. And I didn't understand why you get eye color from one of your parents and hair color from one of your parents, but you don't get your skin color. It kind of goes in the middle. And for the longest time, I was just like, I don't understand how I came out looking like this. And it also caused a bit of a gulf between my mother and my teenage years, because a lot of people in the African-American community view lighter skin as a thing of beauty. And so I, at one point, because I didn't understand the color issues, really thought that I was better than my mother. That's what a lot of people were telling me. And my mother even admits that by marrying a white guy, she thought that I would have an easier time than she did. She said she was teased so bad throughout school, she would put clothespins on her nose and try to bleach her skin to be lighter. So there were a lot of things growing up that were new to my mother in raising me, the way that I was perceived in the Black community and the way that I wasn't readily accepted like she thought I would be because I came out a lighter complexion.
You know, she wanted you to have, biracial role models. So she told you David Hasselhoff was half Black and half white. And apparently you fell for that one.
I know. I mean, you know, there's these moments in your life where you're like, my mom lied to me. And I couldn't stop laughing when I was writing this part of the book because I said, I must have looked so crazy. My mother said, I said, Mom, who looks like me? There's nobody on TV who looks like me. And she said, yes, there is. Knight Rider, David Hasselhoff. And oh my goodness, I couldn't wait to write my Black History Month report on David Hasselhoff. I got an A because my teacher thought, my nun thought that David Hasselhoff was Mr. T. After she had no she had no idea about Black culture. And I was like, and I love Knight Rider because he's half Black like me. And she was like, A. And then she whispers to me, so that's the guy with all the gold chains and the mohawk, right? And I was just like, just say yes, you got an A. And I was like, yes. So I got my first A. David Hasselhoff, I'd like to thank him.
Angela Nissel writes for the NBC series Scrubs. Her new memoir is called Mixed, My Life in Black and White. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Hyperion Books for Children, publisher of the new picture book John, Paul, George, and Ben by author and illustrator Lane Smith. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online. At CAPELLA.EDU. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Fred Barnes talks about Rebel in Chief, his new book in praise of President Bush. Also, more with Angela Nissel about Scrubs.
Out the door, just in time, head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my Superman. I'm no Superman. You've got your love online. You think you're doing fine, but you're just plugged into the wall. And that deck of tarot cards won't get you very far.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Angela Nissel. She's written a new memoir about being the daughter of an African-American mother and a white father. It's called Mixed, My Life in Black and White. She also writes for Scrubs, the NBC comedy about a group of interns and the hospital they work in. You know, something else you write about in your memoir, Mixed, is depression. You've had depression. You were in a hospital in a while, being treated for depression. And you write that being depressed as a Black woman is about as unthinkable as being a feminist Black woman. Why? To whom are both of these things considered unthinkable?
I remember starting college, and we had a big debate about Black women and feminism. And I still talk to my girlfriends about this. To A lot of black women think that the feminist movement was for white women specifically, and that, of course, they could burn their bras because we were still and go out and work because we were still in their homes being their maids. And there is also a want not to put any more burden on black men. And we think that not all of us, but some of us think that if we stand up for our rights as women, we're somehow pushing down black men who have enough problems as it is. So I remember never speaking up about any type of women's rights when I was in college, and never speaking up about how depressed I felt. And they just seemed like the same thing to me, to admit that there's something wrong with me as a black woman or I'm undergoing some kind of stress is just unacceptable.
So if you say you're depressed or you believe in women's rights and in righting certain wrongs about inequality, that makes you a traitor or something?
It makes you a traitor. And it also, for me, because I was hanging on to trying to be accepted by the black community like somebody hangs on to the edge of a cliff, you know, I didn't want to say anything that would make people point to me and say, that's your half white side. That's what side is speaking out right now.
And how did it change for you when you admitted you were depressed and got some treatment for it?
Whew, that was, I told my lovely white academic advisor, I finally admitted to her. I was like, I'm telling a white person only that I'm depressed. And then I said, oh God, please don't let me have a black doctor because they'll be so ashamed of me. And of course I got one of like maybe the four black doctors in the whole hospital when I checked in. I said, oh God, what are you doing? Oh, they're going to give me like, they're going to take away my black pass now. But it changed because when I got into the hospital, half of the patients were black and the majority of them were black women. And for the first time, I got to sit down with other women whose experiences were like mine and talk about issues, like talk about how hard it is to, a lot of them were in the same college I was in too, talk about how hard it was to get by at a mostly white university, how hard it was to feel this way and not have anyone else to talk to about it.
Now, your first book was called The Broke Diaries. Not Broke Back, but Broke.
Yes.
as in out of cash. And yes. I want you to explain the premise of the book.
Oh, that book was how I got through college with no funds whatsoever. I had two jobs, but that still wasn't making ends meet too much. And when you get accepted to college, you think, okay, I just have to pay tuition. And I had a scholarship for tuition, but I didn't understand that it didn't cover boarding and fees and textbooks. So it was about all the things my girlfriends and I used to do to kind of get by, how we learned to make ketchup and mustard sandwiches. We made like 50 meals out of ketchup. Just how I used to work as a security guard for people. So when they went places they were afraid to go by themselves, posing as a professor so that publishing houses would send me free copies of textbooks. Just and I'm surprised to find out that it's become kind of like this cult classic among college students. It's just so odd to me because I wrote it to keep my sanity. I didn't ever expect it to get published. And then one day I get approached by an editor like, would you like to make a book out of this? And I said, oh my goodness, are you serious? So that's how it all started.
Well, one of the things you did during this period when you were broke was do computer dating, and the goal of the date was basically to get a free meal because you figured the guy would treat you.
Yes.
So how often did you do that, and what was your style in doing it?
Oh, my goodness. I was all about newspaper dating. This is, and I guess in a way I still am since I met my husband online. I was all about the ads, the personal ads. So I would just answer personal ads and place my own personal ad and get ready for a date. And thank goodness some men still believed in chivalry because I was so tired of eating the cafeteria lunch and I only could afford the meal plan where you got one meal a day. So when I would go out with guys and they would say, hey, where do you want to meet? I mean, a lot of these dates would only be McDonald's or a coffee shop, but I would at least get like a muffin or a croissant out of it. And we would just go on dates. And I mean, sometimes I liked the guy and we would go on more than one date and they would be happy to treat. And thank goodness for them.
Now, you have your master's degree in medical anthropology. When you were studying medical anthropology, did you ever think you would end up writing for a sitcom about doctors, nurses, residents?
Not at all. I looked in the job bank at University of Penn when I was graduating, and I saw that most people with these degrees, medical anthropology, either went into the Peace Corps, or worked at a museum. And I said, all right, well, I guess I just need to start putting applications in at the museum. When I found out that I was interviewing for the Scrubs position, I said, oh my God, this is so perfect. But actually, I've only been able to use my medical anthropology stuff like twice. Someone's like, hey, we need an exotic illness. And the script is due in like 2 minutes. And I can just throw out, Kuru, that's an exotic illness. And they just put it in the script. And that's the extent that I've been able to add to the show.
How did you get the job on Scrubs? How did you even get to do the interview for the job?
Oh, my goodness. Now, this is a story. I was out here and The Broke Diaries was optioned by a producer. And I thought that meant that I was going to be rich and laid back and I was going to buy my mom a house. It doesn't work like that. You have to have a studio take interest in it. And then you have to actually get it on the air if it's going to be a TV show. So I had moved myself out here to L.A. and I'm planning on being really rich. But so I wasn't. So I put a bunch of stuff up on eBay while I was working some temp jobs. A woman who bid on one of my eBay items happened to be an executive at the WB, which is part of Warner Brothers. And she recognized my name when she saw the return address on the label. And she said, did you write The Broke Diaries? And I said, yes, that's me. She said, what are you doing selling stuff on eBay? You should be writing for sitcoms. Let me introduce you to an agent. I said, oh my goodness, are you serious? She introduced me to an agent. My agent said, oh, okay, I'm going to send you out on some meetings. Write a spec script, which is a script of a show that's on TV that you come up with entirely in your head, and I'll send you on some meetings. Well, I'm from the East Coast, and meeting just means you're having a little meet and greet. When you're interviewing for a job, we actually call them job interviews. So I go out to all these meetings having no idea that what the showrunners are actually doing is looking at my personality to see if I can get along with other people in a writing room. And I come back from these meetings, which took place over the course of about 2 weeks. And he says, you have two job offers. I was like, oh, those were job interviews? You know, I was like, I have a lot to learn about L.A. But that's how I got the meeting. And I wrote the spec script. And it turns out that Bill Lawrence, who's a showrunner for Scrubs, didn't even read it. He was like, I just like The Broke Diaries. I thought the book was funny. And I was like, wow, I could have saved some time there. But if someone in L.A. tells you you're going on a meeting, it's most likely an interview.
Well, Angela Nissel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Angela Nissel writes for the NBC series Scrubs. Her new memoir is called Mixed, My Life in Black and White. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Rebel in Chief, an insurgent leader, an alien in the realm of the governing class. That's how Fred Barnes describes President Bush in his new book. We'll talk with Barnes after a break. This is Fresh Air. At a time when several books by conservatives have made news for their criticisms of President Bush, my guest Fred Barnes has a new book in praise of him called Rebel in Chief, Inside the Bold and Controversial Presidency of George W. Bush. Barnes is executive editor of the Weekly Standard and co-host of the program The Beltway Boys on the Fox News Channel. He formerly covered the Supreme Court and the White House for the Washington Star and was national political correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Fred Barnes, welcome to Fresh Air. There's been several books by conservatives and former Bush administration officials who've become critics of the president. In fact, it almost seems like that's become a genre within the book industry. There's Paul O'Neill's book. He was former Secretary of the Treasury. Richard Clark, former Bush administration counterterrorism expert. Bruce Bartlett, conservative economist and former member of the Reagan administration. Francis Fukuyama, a neoconservative who now thinks the war was a bad idea. Do you see your book in a way as an answer or as a counterpart to those books?
Well, I hadn't planned it that way, that's for sure, because Bruce Bartlett's book hadn't come out. Richard Clark, of course, had voiced his dissent quite publicly after he left the Bush White House, and Paul O'Neill had as well in a book he wrote with another writer, and Frank Fukuyama's book wasn't out. No, my book, the idea was that I would write a book about the Bush presidency, and frankly, it was commissioned at a time in early 2005 or late 2004. It was after I'd written an article, and it was based on an article, this article in the Wall Street Journal. And Bush had been reelected, and he was riding quite high, and so it was about his presidency, which at the time was more successful than it has been really over the bulk of 2005 and into 2006. So it wasn't a response to anything.
It sounds a little bit like, do you want to take back anything you said in the book?
Well, I don't want to take anything back, but clearly President Bush had more success in his first term than he's had in his second term, at least so far. The high point in his second term, I'm afraid, was his inauguration address, January 20, 2005, in which, I thought, an eloquent speech outlined his crusade for democracy in the world. And it's sort of been downhill since there. His Social Security reform initiative failed in 2005. Then we had Katrina. We had Harriet Myers and a number of other things, which really meant that 2005 was, I think, the low point in his presidency.
You describe the president as the rebel-in-chief and as an alien in the realm of the governing class. Now, President Bush is the son of a president. He's used his father's aides and cabinet members as his own aides and cabinet members. His father's Secretary of State, James Baker, ran the Florida recount. Dick Cheney, Powell, Condoleezza Rice were in his father's administration. President Bush raised more money from big donors than any presidential candidate in history. So how is he a rebel or an alien in the realm of the governing class?
Well, Terry, I think in the first place you probably named everybody from his from his father's presidency and campaign the second President Bush has used. And, of course, Jim Baker, he didn't use for anything except the 36 days and was really reluctant to call on him. President Bush, decided at the beginning that anyone who worked for his father's presidential campaign in 1992 would not be a part of his campaign. And, of course, reluctantly at the end, he had to call on Jim Baker during those 36 days of the recount in Florida. And here's how the president is a rebel-in-chief. He's rebelled against the advice of the foreign policy establishment, the event, particularly in Washington. He's rebelled against the political community in Washington, which he has sort of shut out. He certainly rebelled against the press, and I think for all the presidents who didn't like the press, he's probably the one who dislikes the press the most, particularly growing out of his father's unsuccessful 1992 campaign. And when you look at his administration, he didn't hire a bunch of people from Washington. Now, Colin Powell is an exception, who was his first Secretary of State, but most of them were, and Dick Cheney is as well, although Cheney had served in his father's administration, but most of them are other people. Look at his White House staff, they're mostly from Texas.
My guest is Fred Barnes, and his new book about the Bush presidency is called Rebel in Chief. This month, you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "It's time for President Bush to think about a third term." Now, you didn't mean that he should overturn the Constitution, but rather that he should start the equivalent of a third term by filling his presidential staff and cabinet with new faces. Today, the White House Chief of Staff, Andy Card, resigned and was replaced by Budget Director Josh Bolton. Is this a sign that the president has finally listened to you?
Well, I don't know that he's listened to me, but I think he's accepted the reality of the fact that in his second term, that's in something of a rut, he needs to do some dramatic things to change that. And I think this is the first of many personnel changes that we'll see at the White House, starting, of course, with Andy Card gone and Josh Bolton coming in. Josh Bolton, I know, is someone at the White House who believes that fresh blood is necessary and urgently needed.
So you think he needs to make more changes than that, according to the Wall Street Journal article from earlier this month. What other changes would you like to see?
Well, there are just many of them, and I think the most dramatic one would be to anoint a successor to run in 2008 as basically the Bush candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, and the obvious one is Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, who Bush admires and regards almost as a sister. Obviously, the place to put her would be vice president, and that would require Dick Cheney to resign. I think he would do that gladly, actually, and put Condoleezza Rice in there. This is the kind of thing, Terry, that would just grip Washington. You'd have confirmation hearings for the vice president. It would just change the subject in Washington, and that's what the president needs.
A little distraction from things that are going wrong? Is that what you're saying?
Well, just a lot of distraction from things that are controversial and from other things. You'd like to have a subject that you really want to be front and center, and that would be the excitement of a new administration or what would seem like a new administration announcements. The press would have to cover the confirmation hearings and so on, and it would change the subject. And presidents, that's a power they have, the power to change the subject, at least briefly.
It's not typical for a vice president to resign. You're suggesting a very major change. Is this a sign of your lack of or your loss of confidence in the vice president?
No, not at all. I think the vice president's done a fine job, and he could move on and do something else in the administration, be a counselor, be secretary of defense. There are many things he could do, but he doesn't want to run for president in 2008. He's told me personally time after time that he doesn't want to, and it would be good for the president, I think, to anoint someone who does want to run. And Condoleezza Rice is the obvious person.
So what about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld? Is he one of the people you'd like to see be moved to a different position or moved out altogether?
Well, he could be moved to a different position. Certainly he has his critics both inside and outside the administration, mainly outside, but not in the Oval Office. The president supported him. But the idea here, I think, is to really present a new face, a facelift, an overhaul, a transformation of the Bush administration with some new folks in different positions and really rejuvenate the White House. Look, to many people, this would appear desperate. And I don't think the president's in a desperate state yet, but it's just a way to make the last 3 years of his White House term more productive, or at least potentially more productive.
What about Karl Rove? Should he stay or go? You know, a lot of people are saying, well, Andrew Card is no longer the White House chief of staff, but it's Karl Rove that's really running the White House.
Well, he is the deputy chief of staff right now. And I think if you do any overhaul of an administration that doesn't in some way affect Karl Rove, it's not going to be taken seriously. So my advice would be to move Karl to Republican National Chairman and let him run the campaign in 2006. Here's a campaign that starts out with Republicans behind. And he's done great things before. Let him try again.
So clearly you want some people moved out of their current positions, but are there any people from the outside who you'd like to see inside? Are there any people
who you'd like to see join the staff?
You go ahead.
Well, I think there are some people from the outside. I think a perfect person in the Bush administration would be Joe Lieberman, the senator from Connecticut, who's a pariah in the Senate Democratic Caucus now because he supports Bush and in his foreign policy, particularly in Iraq. If Condoleezza Rice moved to the vice presidency, it would make a lot of sense to have Joe Lieberman be Secretary of State. He's someone who would be confirmed and I think a real powerful force in the administration.
Be kind of a paradox, wouldn't it, since after that very hotly contested election in 2000?
It would be quite a paradox, but there are a lot of paradoxes and downright contradictions in politics.
My guest is Fred Barnes. His new book is called Rebel in Chief. Barnes co-hosts the program The Beltway Boys on the Fox News Channel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fred Barnes, and his new book is called Rebel in Chief, Inside the Bold and Controversial Presidency of George W. Bush. In a forum recently co-sponsored by the University of Virginia and a group called the Political Hotline, you said that the Bush people were exhausted by their problems and that, quote, if Iraq turns in a negative direction, the president could be in a position from which he cannot recover, unquote. Do you think we've turned in that negative direction from which the president would not be able to recover?
Well, I think they're treading water now, but once if they can form, as they should, rapidly form a permanent government in Iraq, a government of Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds, a unity government, and that will turn them in the right direction. But look, Iraq is what the Bush administration has come down to be about more than anything else, because even the spinoffs, such as the Crusade for Democracy, or the desire to change the Middle East and so on, they all depend on Iraq. If it's unsuccessful, then the rest of the Bush foreign policy will be unsuccessful, and perhaps not Afghanistan, but certainly most of it. And so the president has a lot riding on this. I mean, the judgment, history's judgment on the Bush presidency will be decided on the basis of Iraq more than anything else.
And how do you think we're doing there now? How does it look to you?
I think we're doing a lot better than people think, but I think there's still a good ways to go. When you know, there's an old saying, Terry, that somebody told me about, an Arab saying, and that is, the dog barks, but the caravan moves on. And the dog's barking. We see a lot of sectarian strife now, and the insurgency is, though weakened, is still obviously able to carry out serious acts of terrorism. But look what's happened. You know, we had all the things that insurgents wanted to stop. They wanted to stop the handover of sovereignty. They wanted to stop the first election. They wanted to stop the formation of an interim government. Then the second and third elections, they wanted to block the approval of a constitution. Now they want to stop the formation of a new government in Iraq. And the terrorism is one of the reasons why I think it hasn't formed.
Have you had second thoughts about the wisdom of the war in Iraq?
Not one.
How come? You seem to have questions about the directions it's heading in.
Well, that's different, though. I mean, I think it was the right thing to do. I still think it's the right thing to do. But there are a lot of problems that have erupted that have some of which I expected, some of which I didn't, that have stopped Iraq from becoming a stable democracy 3 years after Saddam Hussein was toppled. Now, I didn't expect it to be stable by now. I thought, frankly, we'd moved a little farther down the road than we have. But there's been a great deal of success there, as there has been, remains in that society, a great deal of violence. But I think the intervention in the freeing of 25 million people was the right thing to do. Now, if you're an Iraqi now and you want to start a newspaper, you can start one. If you want to start a political party, you can start one. There's a great deal of freedom in Iraq.
You say that the Iraqis are living in freedom now, but a lot of Iraqis, and certainly a lot of American journalists in Iraq, are afraid to leave their house.
They are, but that's and that's why we haven't. The job is not done there by a long shot. There's a great deal to do, particularly in the Baghdad and Sunni area, but in many other areas, the majority of Iraq, we don't have quite those problems. But look, this is a country that has never experienced democracy before. The Iraqis, the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds are having trouble learning the need for compromise, which has made it hard to form this permanent government based on the December 15th election. And so though the dog barks, though, I do think the caravan continues to move on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Fred Barnes. His new book about the Bush presidency is called Rebel in Chief. I think what a lot of critics have trouble with when it comes to the Bush administration is the sense of spending and cutting taxes at the same time. The Washington mm-hmm. Post said in an editorial, Bush has racked up more new debt during his 5 years in office than the entire debt amassed by the U.S. through 1988. The president's mm-hmm. budget envisions the debt rising to $11.5 trillion by 2011. Are you comfortable with that level of debt?
Sure. One of the great things about President Reagan and President Bush is they haven't been spooked by the deficit. What matters is economic growth and employment and jobs, and they've produced those. I mean, the President Bush, when he came into office, he had a recession, he had 9/11, he had the stock market collapse, which was the most important thing, which had raised tremendous revenues in the last several years of the Clinton administration. And the President realized what he needed to do was spur the economy, get it going again. And then, of course, we've had the war and we've had Katrina and many of these other things which have jacked up the deficit. But by historic standards, it's not that great. I mean, I think in 2005, it was 2.6% of GDP. Not great, but certainly not much higher than the average of the deficit over the last 40 years. I think the average is something like 2.5.
Bruce Bartlett, the conservative economist who has mm-hmm. a book criticizing the president, describes the president as having bankrupted the country.
Yeah, I don't know what he... I haven't read his book. Look, I've known Bruce for 25 years and liked him. I don't know, but I haven't read his book, Imposter, so I really don't know what he bases that on. That's not something I believe is true, but maybe he can explain it in a way that I might find more convincing.
Well, I think basically what he's saying is that this is the kind of debt you can never really pay off, that generations mm-hmm. will have to... will remain in debt, and that we are now going to be... kind of at the mercy of countries like China to buy our debt in order to stay afloat. Mm-hmm.
Well, why wouldn't they want to buy it? Where would you buy debt if you were a foreign country? What is the safest debt you could buy anywhere in the world?
But doesn't that give But does that give them a certain control over our financial future?
Not at all. Somebody, if they don't buy it, somebody else will buy it. They're smart in buying it. The Japanese buy it. I don't see them as having any control. I don't think that's not a great worry I have anyway. And maybe Bruce has that worry, but I haven't talked to him recently, though I have many times over the last 25 years.
Fred Barnes, I'm wondering what your reaction was to the memo from Vice President Cheney's staff, and this is the memo that kind of outlined what his requirements are when he's traveling on the road. And one of those requirements is that the TVs in his hotel rooms must be turned to Fox News. It's your network. So what was your reaction when you saw that?
Well, thank heavens. I always tell I go to hotels and they frequently don't have Fox. I always tell them, you really need to get Fox. I noticed I saw John Kerry's specifications now that were just published on Monday, and he didn't require Fox. I guess I knew ahead of time that Cheney was a great Fox watcher. It tends to be, the Fox doesn't get as many casual viewers. Many of them are chronic viewers, if you want to call them that, and I'm glad Dick Cheney's won.
Fred Barnes, thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it.
Fred Barnes' new book is called Rebel in Chief. He's executive editor of the Weekly Standard, and he co-hosts the Beltway Boys on the Fox News Channel. You can read an excerpt of his book on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From Acura, sponsor of NPR podcasting, including the web-only music special All Songs Considered at npr.org/podcasts. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art and its current exhibition of paintings by Edvard Munch. MOMA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You may know them as Mike D, MCA, and Ad Rock, or as Michael Diamond, Adam Yauch, and Adam Horovitz. On the next Fresh Air, the Beastie Boys. For their new concert film, Awesome, they gave cameras to their fans in the audience. Join us for the next Fresh Air.